Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 68, The Soul of Counseling, January 1st, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
It's just been a little bit too ethereal for the profession to really talk about the soul, because it's not an easy thing to talk about. It's not talked about in the culture at large. It's not something that's quite easily to measure, although as I got thinking about it, particularly in counseling, that it's all the core conditions of counseling. It's all about acceptance and understanding and congruence and enthusiasm, and all those things are spiritual terms. And acceptance that Rogers talks about, and all the core conditions. Those are not just cognitive things, and they're certainly not just dealing with emotions. They're dealing with the whole person, the spirit of the person. We have a spiritual energy field that we need to acknowledge, and we have the core of that spiritual energy field is what I call the soul.
That was the voice of my longtime friend and guest, Dr. Dwight Webb, who has written the 2005 book, The Soul of Counseling, A New Model for Understanding Human Experience. He also wrote an earlier book titled 50 Ways to Love Your Leaver, Getting On with Your Life After the Breakup. He earned his PhD in counseling psychology at Stanford University and is now associate professor in the Counselor Education Program at the University of New Hampshire. Beyond this, he has presented workshops in Europe and throughout the United States on themes related to future visions of psychological well-being. Here's the interview. Hey, Brother Dwight, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks. It's a privilege to be on with you here. It's great to hear your voice.
Okay, now I'm wondering what kind of weather you're having there in New Hampshire today.
Well, we had our first snow there yesterday. We got 2 or 3 inches, and it's melting quickly today.
And here I am in California. The sun is shining brightly. We've had temperatures in the 40s, and I have to tell you that when it's in the 40s here, it's kind of like in the 30s there. It just feels cold in Northern California when the temperature drops.
We've had a very warm winter. And usually we have a white Christmas, and we did not have a white Christmas this year.
Oh, my goodness. Well, look, I've wanted to talk to you about the book you've written called The Soul of Counseling.
And you
and I have been buddies and soul brothers for close to 30 years now. So
I know.
Yeah. So I'm hoping...
1979.
Oh, let's not... You're right. I already let the cat out of the bag with 30 years, so you're right. So I'm hoping that that soul connection between you and me comes through now, despite the distance and the fact that we're recording our conversation.
Yeah, you betcha. I always feel that connection when we're together and when we're on the phone.
Yeah, me too. Now, I've been reading your book, and I'm really liking it very much. How did you come to write a book about soul? Isn't that kind of academically a sort of risky thing to do?
Well, it is. I guess maybe I got to the point in academia where it didn't really matter. I could just write what I wanted to, and I didn't really write it for academic credit in that sense. But what struck me too was that nobody's writing about it. You know, we always talk about. I think everybody agrees pretty much that we have a soul, but we don't talk about it. And I find that very curious. And then I started thinking about it, that psychology means study of the soul. And I've been a psychologist for 30 or 40 years and never hear the word soul. And it might be more in pastoral counseling, but I doubt it. And when you do hear it, it's always associated with religion. And I thought, but, you know, whether you go to church or believe in a religious affiliation or some kind, We have a soul regardless. We have a spiritual soul, whether we're religious or not. And how we define it, often I see a real commonality in the way we define it. I've given a little survey to my students and also people that come to my workshops and ask them to define soul. And generally they see it as that inner self, that being within, that kind of is the guide. Some people would say, well, that's my connection to the Lord or to the God force. But mostly it's just seen as that innermost being that's kind of pure and maybe the moral guide. I thought, well, that's interesting because we don't talk about it. It seems to me we should. And that's really one of the things that got me writing about it. It was just a deficiency in our field, for one thing. We've talked about everything on the external, about behavior and about cognition and about emotion and social interaction. But where does it come from?
Yeah,
it comes from inside.
Yeah, in your book, you do point out that if you break down the word psychology, it's psyche and ology, and psyche refers to soul, and ology is study of. And yet, as you point out, psychology moved very far away from any discussion of the soul. What's the story with that? Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think there are two things. I think one is as a profession, academically, we've tried to be accountable and to be scientific and to have things statistically significant and show our accountability and measure things and behavior and so on and have labels and categories and all the sort of external things that you can point to. And it's just been a little bit too ethereal for the profession to really talk about the soul, because it's not an easy thing to talk about. It's not talked about in the culture at large. It's not something that's quite easily to measure, although as I got thinking about it, particularly in counseling, that it's all the core conditions of counseling. It's all about acceptance and understanding and congruence and enthusiasm, and all those things are spiritual terms, and acceptance. That Rogers talks about, and all the core conditions. Those are not just cognitive things, and they're certainly not just dealing with emotions. They're dealing with the whole person and the spirit of the person. So in my book, as you have seen, I'm sure if you've looked at it, I have a model of what the old model, which doesn't really talk about the center of the person, talks about the external measurable things, but that we have a spiritual energy field that we need to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And we have the core of that spiritual energy field is what I call the soul.
Yeah.
That generates that.
Yeah. Now, you teach in a counselor education program, and I think you kind of identify yourself as a counselor. And in the book, you mentioned you were drawn more to counseling as a student than to clinical psychology. And I think maybe that had something to do with maybe your early sense of the soul. Can you say a bit about that choice?
Well, yeah, I absolutely look back now on my career and my beliefs and so on, and I'm much more interested in the whole person and not just in pathology. I'm interested in human development, and counseling has always really looked at that and emphasized that as a special interest of psychology, looking at the development of the whole person. And as a school counselor for 7 years, that certainly was the mission that we had, is to try and develop the best possible circumstances to help children develop in a school setting. The clinical model, to me, the old Freudian models and the diagnostic things, I just wasn't so interested in it. But, you have to conform, and in graduate school and so on, you've got to have everything statistically significant.
Right.
And you emphasize all this. See, for example, my dissertation came out of looking at kids that were coming to my office in the school who were essentially wounded souls. I see that now. But I looked at it as, well, they've got a problem with a teacher, they've got a problem with a parent, and they're not doing very well socially, and they have low self-esteem and so on. And all those things were, of course, true, but the core or root condition was, or is that we at school or at home, in the homes, weren't providing the kind of nurturing that children need to develop well. They were getting ridiculed in school. They were getting humiliated with a teacher who thought that they could be sarcastic and shape their behavior. But all those things were detrimental. And it wasn't just an affective impact, although that's what I called it in my dissertation. I think it was a spiritual wound. I think they come out of that with a sense of identity that's been wounded.
Yeah, you tell us.
And I think it's a wound to the soul. That's what I'm saying.
I like that expression that you use in the book, referring to soul wounds. And by the way, feel free to throw in any little case history incidents that come to mind. I know you had a number of them scattered throughout the book, and I don't know if they're at the top of your mind now. And I didn't frame any questions around that particularly, but I hope you'll kind of keep that in mind. And if an incident comes up.
Well, I get one image in mind, but I won't go into that right now, but it may come up. But it is a bigger picture. Even the film that I made, David, you might remember in the early 70s before you came to New Hampshire, I had done a film on elementary school counseling, and I was using paraprofessionals. And as I said in that film, these people were hired because they had the right spirit. They had the right gift to give to kids. They were warm, and they were kind, and they were friendly, and they were accepting, and all those kind of spiritual gifts that we give to each other. And they weren't hired because they had a PhD or an MA or an MED in counseling. They were hired because they were good people who'd had very positive experiences with children. And I didn't see it and frame it in those days in terms of the human spirit. And I called it, I had actually had a grant to identify and treat pre-delinquent children. And so that was kind of the language. And we were looking for children that weren't adapting very well in ages 6 through 10, grades 1 through 4. What we brought to them essentially was a surrogate parent or grandparent to spend time with them and to listen to them and to care about them in ways that maybe other personnel at the schools didn't take the time for these kids. They were just being passed over because of other obligations that school staff had. And so I saw so there's a consistent theme in my work about the human spirit, but it didn't get framed in this way because to write about spirit was just not okay in the profession. And I just will comment that I think that started to open up as we became more concerned and focused on multicultural concerns in counseling. So that's been for the last 10 or 15, 20 years. But so now we're looking at cultural things, and now we see there are lots of differences in spiritual terms between different cultures. And so it's okay to talk about those, and now it's okay to talk about the spirit and religion. But you asked a question, I said there were a couple things, and scientific, the piece was one, and the other is religion. David, I'd like listeners to know this, because I think it's an important omission in our culture. Most people, if you ask them, are you a spiritual person, they say, oh yes, I'm a Protestant, or I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Jew. They identify spirituality with their religion. I was raised a Methodist, or whatever, I'm a Muslim, and so on.
Sure.
And they don't see the spirit within, they see it without. So they're worshiping idols and people, and Jesus, and Buddha, and Allah, and all these other external figures, Muhammad, and they don't really look within to find that human spirit that they can manifest and how it's manifest.
Yes, I love the way in the book you say that the soul is about our inner life rather than about religion.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're saying right now. you got a dog, don't you?
yeah, the dog, we do. We got a new dog, and she's barking out there. I'll have to see if I can... Maybe Dusty will figure that out.
Yeah, that's okay. We can live with the dog. The dog's soul can join with ours here.
Yeah, right.
You know, in your book, you say that when you wrote the book, which I guess was it came out a year ago, you said you felt you had a unique slant on soul. How would you describe that unique slant?
Well, I think it's unique in that, number one, it's been a taboo subject. Nobody's talked about it, so that's unique in the field. And even in pastoral counseling, where the spirit is some concerned, it's always paired with religion. I looked at one article that had been written, and there were 113 references for this article on spirituality, and 97 of them had religion and spirituality paired in the title of their work. Mm-hmm. And in all of the work, religion and spirituality were seen as one and the same. And I have a chapter in my book that talks about the differences between religion and spirituality. Religion is essentially a man-made institution. It's a human invention to try and help define that which is sacred, and it's fine. I'm not trying to knock anybody away from their religion, but I would like them to say, regardless of my religion, I've got something inside me that resonates with being alive and with relationships and my attitudes about things. And I think too often it just doesn't get looked at.
Yeah. You've got a number of marvelous lists in your book, and early in the book you have a list of 8 assumptions about human experience. And I'd like to read those and share them with our audience because I think they do kind of undergird a lot of what you're saying. So this is from 8 assumptions about human experience. It may ring a bell. It may ring a bell with you.
Well, it sure does. And I've got a copy of the book on my desk, which I can open, I guess, or on my bookshelf.
Yeah. Okay. The first is we are more than our thoughts, and you can comment on any of these if you want to. I'll just run through them, and then we can look back at them if we feel like we want to. The first is we are more than our thoughts. Number 2, we're more than our emotions. Number 3, we're more than our behavior. Number 4, we're more than our physical bodies. Number 5, there is a soul behind all these domains. Number 6, all genuine compassion and caregiving comes from our soul, which is the wellspring of love. 7, our soul considers all options for survival and development and is the foundation of our choice-making. And then finally, 8, as our soul is nourished, we gain in awareness of ourself and in relationships.
Yeah, not bad. I that sounds pretty good to me. And I guess it's interesting. I'm sure there's not just 8. There's probably somebody could expand that list or question some of them. But I think that does touch upon some of the core thinking that I had about trying to get people to look beyond behavior and emotion and physical issues and social interaction and so on, and to see that there's something pushing that, motivating that, making the decisions, and that it is an essence of ourselves that can be nourished, and it also can be wounded by neglect, by betrayal, by harsh, hostile action toward us, and so on.
Now, you come back to the wounded part again, and you tell a story in the book. You know, these wounds often happen in childhood, and sometimes they're things that from the outside might seem very small, very trivial, but yet it's amazing how long they hang on, or we hang on to them. And you tell a story about you were working with your grandfather building something, and he made a comment about your carpentry skills. Tell us that story here.
Oh, that was really funny, but it hurt my feelings. My grandfather was a carpenter in the early part of the 20th century. He was pretty much through by 1950, I guess. But so he did everything by hand. He cut by all the 2x4s and all the boards with a handsaw and a hammer and a nail, and that's the way he built. And so I was over helping him one day and on some minor tasks around the house, but he asked me to cut a board for him or something. He kind of showed me how to measure a line and how to cut it and get it just right. And he made a comment after I'd done that, which was discouraging. He said, "Oh, you don't have it." And he said, "Your brother's got it. I have an older brother, as you know."
Yeah.
But you don't have it, son.
In terms of being able to draw lines or hammer nails?
Being able to cut a straight line or so on. And so what's interesting is that I was probably 10 or 12 years old, and here I am now in my 70s, and I still remember that comment. Now that's just stuck in there.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's influenced me in a real hurtful or negative way, because I've gone on and designed and built several houses myself.
I know, you're building one right now.
Yeah, I just finished one. It's wonderful. And I have an eye for aesthetics and for things that please my spirit. And details are, of course, a part of that. But I don't consider myself a skilled carpenter. I hire people now to do that work. But it was a hurtful thing, and I don't know that it wounded me greatly through my development. But somehow I overcame that with some confidence because I got involved and did building projects and stuff, even as a young man.
Well, maybe that's part of our adaptation to these wounds. I mean, either we cave in to the wound, and if it's, you know, that's relatively small, and if you have a really serious wound, it's not so
or
easy
exactly,
to rebound.
Exactly. I had enough nurturing going on within my family from other uncles or my mom particularly or my dad who said, the other interesting thing about that is I can only remember my dad giving me two or three things that he said that were very complimentary, but they stuck. I can remember those too. Mm-hmm. And they were very nurturing to my spirit. I needed to have that kind of confirmation. And you know, I think I got a good share of that from my family and from my community and my peers and my teachers and stuff when I was growing up.
That'd be a good exercise, really, to reflect on what those early positive messages were that we have taken on. I need to sit back and think about that myself. when I read your carpentry story, it triggered a couple of memories for me from my grandmother in particular. I remember once she commented on my hands. I was maybe about the same age that you're talking about, 8 or 9 years old. And she said, and I have very small hands, unusually small hands for a man, I think. I'm probably still self-conscious about that. She said, oh, David, you have small hands. That means you're a dreamer. And I took that in a very negative, well, there's a way in which it could be great. You know, I went on to do a lot of work with dreams. But the way that I took it and in that context was, you're not a doer. I think she may have gone on to say that. You know, you don't have you don't have the hands of a doer. You have the hands of a dreamer. Uh-huh. Oh, boy, that just drains all the energy out.
Yeah, you know? Really.
Like, oh, no, I can't do. I'm always just going to be a dreamer.
And as you say that, it's like those kind of words have a hypnotic charge to them.
Hmm.
It's as if they're telling you something like they're a witch or something. And all of a sudden, you better believe it because they've got so much authority.
Yes, you're right.
And it sticks in there like hypnosis.
Right.
And you know about hypnosis better than I do.
Yeah. In your book, you give examples of, I think it really called your, you tell a story of how you were really called to the concept of the wounded soul. I think someone was telling you about early childhood sexual abuse or something about which they were terrified.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's a client that I've seen periodically since 1984. I haven't seen her now for about a year, although I did talk with her a few days ago, and she's going to make an appointment, so I still have contact with her. She's the most wounded soul I've ever met or seen. She's very afraid to be out in the world, and she had not only a father who was sexually inappropriate and abusive as a when she was 4 and 5 years old. Her mother was also very harsh and strict and punitive. And she had brothers that picked on her. And she just went inside herself and was never really able to make friends or to be comfortable out in the world. And so she ended up being hospitalized with depression and getting diagnosed as borderline and schizophrenic and lots of other things. And here's this sensitive soul who's got a great deal of love to give to people, but she's afraid to be out in the world to give it. She did have a son, and she did a marvelous job raising her son. In fact, that's how I came to know her. She called because when her boy was only 4 years old, and of course he's out of college now, but and thinking going about getting a doctorate in philosophy, very bright, good, fine lad. But at age 4, he wasn't adapting very well in school, and so the teacher said maybe he should just have some counseling or something. So somehow she got my name and called me. And I, as soon as I saw her, I thought, well, I can probably be most helpful to this boy if I can work with this mom. And so I started seeing her, and I did fix up a big brother kind of a relationship with the boy. I had my son John working with him. And that was a very positive thing. And over the years, you know, she's gotten somewhat quite a lot better in certain ways, but she's still very, very wounded and very, very depressed about life's opportunities. Those kinds of wounds just were so severe that she never really became fully functioning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The really severe early wounds are much harder to bounce back from. And yet I'm struck by the way that, you know, even though she's had all of these diagnoses hung on her, you refer to her as a very sensitive soul. And somehow you're looking past the diagnoses that she's been given in the past and seeing this inner light and this inner potential and supporting that.
Yes, exactly. That's right. I see. She is a very kind person and a very loving person, and so I do. I think it's a what's the word I want? I think it's a disservice to put labels like that on her because I don't know whether it's in the book or not. I can't remember whether I put it in there, but she once wrote a piece about labeling. I think it might be in there in the chapter on assessment about how labels hurt, and. You know, she says in the little essay that she wrote about that, why can't they just see them as a person instead of as some category?
Yes.
And, you know, that speaks to me. I mean, it spoke to my soul when I read that and we talked about it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's absolutely right. I think we have to be very careful about throwing around labels and diagnoses. And I do talk about that in the book under assessment chapter because it doesn't get at the real issue of this is a person who's struggling. You know, I suppose we could talk a lot about what kind of approaches we might use, and I think sometimes diagnostic language can be useful in communicating with other professionals, and certainly it's necessary to communicate with insurance companies, but it's much deeper, you know that too.
Yeah. And I was interested in your observation that the profession has placed too much emphasis and spend too much time squabbling over therapeutic techniques and methods. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, yeah. When I was in graduate school, there were several schools, and often they would have their own approach, and that would become dominant. For example, Stanford was, and I think still is, very behavioralistically oriented in psychology, and I suppose to some extent education, and we're seeing that continue now in a lot of different forms. But reality therapy comes along, and of course the psychodynamic stuff has been there, and the Jungian influence has been there, and everybody thinks they've got a corner of the universe that's got all the pure truth for everything and every person for all time. And it's silly. I mean, all of them have made a contribution, but we need to not sort of just get locked into a theory and try to make that hold sway over all of our relationships with our clients.
Right. You know, I just interviewed someone else. I don't know if you know his work. Scott D. Miller.
What's the last name?
Miller.
Scott Miller. Yes, I know that name.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to attend a workshop that he's doing next weekend. I interviewed him recently because a listener had recommended him, and he and another guy wrote a fabulous book called The Client as Hero. I think that's the Heroic Client. And they did a meta-analysis of 40 years of research on psychotherapy. And they found that the school, you know, the technique, the therapeutic school, only accounted for about 15% of the variance at the most. And the largest parts of variance were accounted for by client resources, client strength. In other words, that's most of what works in therapy and counseling are the internal resources of the person, their soul strength, if you will.
Their soul strength, yeah.
And then the second most powerful influence was the relationship, the therapeutic alliance it's sometimes referred to.
Interesting, yeah. What's the name of the book, The Heroic Client?
Yeah.
I'll have to get that.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. They approach that topic with fire and brimstone, and also really attack the whole diagnostic, the reliance on diagnosis and so on. You know, part of what I love about your book and your whole approach to spirituality and soul is that you ground it in everyday concepts and words. I remember when we were in Ireland, we did a workshop together in Ireland, and and you've read an early portion of this book that you were working on then. And, you know, you use words like, and you just earlier in our conversation, I think you referring to this woman, you use words like loving and kind and, you know, genuine, creative. And
Right.
And those are the kinds of words that you see as expressive of the soul.
Exactly. And interestingly enough, I think they meet good criteria for being scientifically valid, that we can observe kindness, we can observe caring, we can see acceptance. And if we're working with our training counselors and we observe this behavior, we can comment on it in feedback. Or if we're not seeing enough of that, if we don't see the kind of compassion that we think needs to be there when the client is telling their story or something, we can comment on that. And so it's a very big part of process teaching, I guess, is what I would, how I would put it in there. I think too often I see even in our field, these textbooks that we have and are so focused on content and theory, although I do very much like, I have to say a word, kind word for Jerry Corey, because he does focus a lot on process, and he certainly talks a lot about spirituality as well. And I use a lot of his books, but it isn't as if these spiritual dimensions of individuals, of all of us, aren't recognizable. They are. What's surprising is that they're not part of our language. We don't refer to them as spiritual. We don't refer to them as intellectual or as emotional. We just kind of know they're out there. We sort of just take it for granted. Well, yeah, he's a kind person. He's got a big heart. He's very caring, or she's very loving, and so on. That's the other piece that seems to be missing in our professional literature is love. You know, even Rogers, who was the greatest of all of us in talking about this condition, had to frame it as unconditional positive regard because the culture couldn't accept the L word.
Yes, right, the L word.
and even now, I think it's a little bit hard to take. We go, oh, well, we can't talk about love. We got work to do here.
But there is a kind of love, a caring, a holding, right, that you bring to your work.
Absolutely.
With
absolutely. I mean, caring and compassion are expressions of love.
Yeah.
And acceptance and understanding, those are all part of love.
Yeah.
Love's the big tip of the umbrella, but it sort of reaches out and covers a whole range of expressions that humans make with each other to nurture and to support and to encourage and all those things.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I feel that with my audience for this show, even though I don't know the people personally, directly, most of them, there is a sort of generalized sense of love or caring or nurturing that I feel.
That's great. I want to hear more about that at some point.
Okay,
I do, because I think what you're doing is very, although I don't fully understand it, it's very creative, and I'm glad that you've got an audience out there that you're resonating with, and they're with you.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful feeling, because I get a lot back from the audience as well that tells me, okay, there's something that's connecting here, and that's been very affirming for me.
Yeah.
I love the fact that in your book you mentioned the importance of music as a dimension of soul or something that evokes soul. And of course, it was our mutual love of music and folk music in particular that really helped you and me to bond together at a soul level.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that and skiing.
But, exactly.
But talk about music a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, the images that I get are just those of singing with friends and with family and playing guitar, banjo, whatever, and just participating in some of the traditions of the music that's been written, and some of it new music, some of it very old music, connects us in ways with each other and also with the songwriter. I mean, some of our best poets, I think, have been the people that have written some of the folk tunes. James Taylor, so many of his songs are all about love. Shower the people you love with love, you know, for example. And So I think it speaks directly to the soul, but not just the lyric, just the harmony of music, the melodies. Something resonates deep within us when we hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It can be peaceful. It can be very joyful. Maybe it can even be a little bit sad and help you get in touch with that side of the spirit if you're in a mournful place. All those things, I think, have healing energy, and without words.
Yeah, I was just in a bookstore yesterday, and I saw a book. I didn't buy it. I probably should have, but some scientist type guy up in Canada has written a book on music, and he's studied it at the brain level and so on, and he understands it, at least at an intellectual, scientific level.
Uh-huh.
But deeper than that, because they mentioned he's also a musician himself, and I think I want to follow up with that guy.
I'd be interested in that as well. I think sometimes people who are trying to understand something like that try to analyze it to death, and in a way, I think we just have to accept there's a certain mystery about it, that it speaks to us, and we don't exactly have to figure out each each sound wave to know what triggers what.
Right.
I think we can. I'm not accusing this guy of doing that, but I think very often that's what happens in technical books, is we just overanalyze it to death and look at it from such a logical perspective that it'll make us believe it.
Yeah, you've never
we read, already know it.
You've never read anything so dry as books and papers on the psychology of humor. They're so unfunny.
But it's like if let's say I came to a lecture you were giving and I resonate with it and it just lights me up and stuff, and what's happened is I'll hear things that I didn't know I knew, and all of a sudden you put words and frame it in such a way that, so there's a spiritual connection. We know somehow we can resonate with that. It's like music in a way. I think there's something that gets triggered, and we're drawn to it. We're drawn to an idea. We're drawn to a concept because it seems like this is a truth. I already knew that, but I didn't know I knew it.
Recognition. So somehow that sense of recognition connects to that to that soul part, that deep soul part.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like Plato, you know, that we already have all of this stuff inside and we've forgotten it. And something elicits this recognition of some inner truth.
How many times have you met somebody and right away you knew you liked them?
Yeah.
Just even though you don't know anything about them, but you know that they're trustworthy and honest and funny. You can see it in their eyes. You can see it in their smile. And you just feel a rapport with them. I mean, that's, and within a matter, I've had that happen, and I'm sure that's what happened when I met you and we went to lunch that day and realized that there was a camaraderie and some spiritual connection. We didn't talk necessarily about it, but there was an instant kind of bonding, and that's happened with me in many occasions.
Yes.
And I think it does happen with people.
Yeah.
You just know.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's true.
And I think it's, you know, what it kind of boils down to, even the job interview. You know, people, okay, well, he came from a good school, and yes, he's got these good grades and the good letters of reference, but what really matters is you sense something in that person. You sense the integrity of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a much deeper spiritual kind of way of assessing. My friend Greg Goodman has written a book called Ubiquitous Assessment, and it's about picking up on all these nonverbal cues and looking at everything from the moment I write about in my book, from the moment you meet the person, see them, start to pick up cues.
Okay, I'm going to bringing you back to the book here. In your chapter on building a theory of soul in counseling, you cite four basic tenets of the soul of counseling, and let me read those, and then you can comment as you feel appropriate.
Yeah.
And because in part your book, I think you're writing to people who want to be counselors, and so you're trying to build kind of a framework for how you would see approaching it in a soulful way.
Exactly. Yes. Either they want to be, or maybe they're just thinking about their own professional development. I'd like them to entertain this as an idea,
Mm-hmm. And so the first tenet that you have is, Within each of us, there is a soul and awareness of self as an autonomous being.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that, and as I mentioned earlier, about how people recognize that inner self,
and
that autonomy, and that a lot of the decisions, their motivation, their interests, and their attitudes are all kind of driven. The choices they make are driven from that inner self or that autonomous being. We do come, it's the existential question too, isn't it? About we come to the realization that we're alone on this planet. We are separate individual beings, and we need each other, and we need family. We need friends for getting along and maximizing our lives. Mm-hmm. But we do sense that autonomy that we have as well.
Yes. Now, your second tenet is our soul mediates all of our thoughts, feelings, choices, and actions.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I like that word mediates, but I didn't find a better one. That is, I think we get all this stimuli from outside and or inside, and it sort of bounces around in there. Well, I guess logically I ought to do this, or maybe I should do that, but this feels better. And we're weighing all these considerations of how we should be and how we should act in special circumstances. And sometimes gets very distorted with greed, for example, or just self-serving behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so if we quiet and listen and really say, well, I really know, if I want to ask my soul about that, I really know what the right thing to do is here. And I think because we've gotten soul lessons in our culture as children, we know maybe through our church, our schools, our families, our friends, and so on, we know kind of, well, what's appropriate, what's right, what's respectable, what's the best thing in the long run, and so on. And so it's that kind of mediation process that goes on, that if we go into ourselves, we will know what we should be doing here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant by that. It's not just a social interactive thing. It's not just an intellectual piece or an emotional thing. That there's some inner awareness of our options, and we can be guided by that awareness about which how we want to respond, how we want to behave. So I think mediates is as good a word as I can think of for that.
And then you've got a third tenet here. Human life depends on love. There's the L word again.
There's the L word again, and it obviously we know that from some of the early studies in psychology around the Spitz studies about infants that don't get touched in love die. And I can't remember the other guy who did the work with the monkeys and stuff and the soft. You probably would remember that.
Harry Harlow.
Harlow, yeah. Yeah. And we know that compassion brings life out of an infant. If we're cooing and cuddling and tickling and kissing our child, we know that that sparks something in there. So it is that kind of love that does create the human spirit or nurtures the human spirit.
And then finally, you've got tenet four, all life seeks to survive and to fulfill itself. And I guess that's probably pretty self-explanatory. But.
Well, I think so. I like what Karen Horney said about the acorn. We don't have to teach the acorn how to be an oak tree. We just have to provide the right conditions, or the right conditions have to be existent for the soil and the weather and the water and so on. And then you leave that thing alone, and it's gonna fulfill itself with the conditions are right. And I think that analogy is true for humans as well. If we don't want to be too overbearing about it, but if we provide the right conditions, I think the person will develop the fullness because they have the capacity, the potential.
Yeah,
to do that.
You talk about creating the conditions, and that leads me to another one of your lists that I liked a lot. Actually, sort of built a chapter around it, and I just want to run through these quickly because time's getting on. But you called it 10 things I want my clients to experience. And so I think that really speaks to what you're talking about in terms of creating the conditions for growth and change and healing.
Yes, and exactly. So thank you for that.
Yeah, number one is being welcomed. Number two is being acknowledged. You know, we all want to be welcomed and we want to be acknowledged.
Exactly.
Number three is trust as the foundation of our work together. Number four is power within themselves, which, you know, refers to what I was talking about, Scott Miller discovering that most of the healing comes from within the person, right?
Yes, so, and that's the job of the counselors to help them discover that.
Yeah, yeah. You say, I want clients to know that they have the power within themselves to create and choose the changes they want and that it's their responsibility. And you go on from there. Number five, facilitation for personal growth. Number six is that I have belief and faith in them. What a wonderful thing to communicate to your clients, that you have belief and faith in them. I'm sure that's healing. Number seven, freedom from diagnosis, judgment, and categories. We spoke about that. Eight is counselor transparency. Say what you mean by that, counselor transparency.
Well, I like that. That really is a Rogers idea, I guess, that I'm carrying forward. The idea of being congruent and being authentic, genuine, who we are, and to let our clients see that and know that and to know where we're coming from and to not have a hidden agenda in our work with them, but to be just out there with who we are. That's why, although I don't see many clients these days, I think when I do, I like to give them a copy of that book so they'll know a lot about what I believe in.
Oh, yeah.
How I want to work.
Yeah, that's great.
I remember Rogers had a quote that I like very much about being transparently real. Mm-hmm. And I think congruence is another good word that goes with that idea.
Right. Your ninth point, I think, is very important. Challenge with support.
Yes.
So they both have to be there. A little challenge to stimulate the growth, but the support to hold them through the process.
Exactly. And I think we've missed that point in some ways. I don't want to put a blanket condemnation on our professionals, but too often we've used the word confrontation, which is, I think, a very harsh, much more harsh word, and to confront them with the way things are and so on, and that sort of kind of holding their nose to the fire, well, you better get with it. If you're going to do it, when are you going to do it kind of stuff, and that's fine to kind of put that challenge out there. But I think it has to be given with support. It has to be given with the whole context of understanding what the client may be, what are some of the barriers to that. What's keeping you? How do you sabotage yourself?
Yeah.
But not being afraid to talk about those things in session. Mm-hmm. Not holding back because, well, it might hurt the client's feelings. We have to challenge them to look at things, that patterns and so on, that maybe aren't working well for them and how they developed and so on, but to do it in a way that's kind and caring and supportive.
Yeah, and then your 10th point is reliance upon their own soul in personal decisions. You write, at some point in the counseling process, I will need to broach the idea of soul in such a way that it is acceptable and not in conflict with the client's religious or other spiritual beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I'm not trying to get converts here, but I would like them to take a look inside and see what they have they're formed as, you know, that inner guide or that inner self. And so I do want them to know that that power is has to do with the power within. That has to do with, you know, that's another thing that sort of struck me recently, is that often we talk about empowering people as if we are giving them the power. And mm-hmm. I think that gives a mistaken notion. I think what we need to do is help them discover the power within, and they empower themselves. We don't empower them. Maybe we facilitate the empowerment, but we're not God in this thing. Except that, you know, I like what Kennedy said in his inaugural. He said, here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. Well, I can buy into a God like that. I mean, to think of all these are expressions of a higher being, that to get along and survive in the world, we've got to love each other and mm-hmm. care about each other and take care of each other.
Mm-hmm. And then I love the way that you implement some of these principles that we've been talking about. In the appendix to the book, you've got a kind of contract that the client and the counselor can sign. You call it the Client-Counselor Agreements of Understanding. I think this is a great model that therapists out there might want to pick up on.
And, thanks.
Yeah, and you write, there are two parts. There's the client part and then the counselor part. And in the client part, it says, As a client, I agree to, one, bring no harm to myself or to others. Okay, that's great. Get them to promise not to kill themselves or anybody else.
Yeah.
So we can do this work. Point two, put concentrated effort into my own personal growth during the 167 hours of each week between sessions. This would include cooperating with assignments such as behavioral rehearsals, understanding cognitive distortions, bibliotherapy, etc. Three, be challenged toward my growth path. Four, explore my own resistance. Five, write my personal reflections in my journal on a regular basis. And then there's a place for the client to sign.
Yeah.
Now that sounds like that really sets it up for, okay, here's what I expect of you. And
yes.
And it's good stuff.
Yeah, thanks. I like that idea too, and I especially like the idea of using journals because it does put the responsibility for them to do. I think the journal gives them voice for that inner self to just write their musings and their reflections and their hopes and dreams and fears. I think gets a lot of that stuff out there without. What happens is we get so distracted. You know, we're all a little bit ADD, I guess. Mm-hmm. We may be thinking along about that inner self and our decisions and our struggles and why we went into therapy and all. But, geez, I got to write some checks and pay the bills. I've got to run down to the market and I've got to do this and that. And we don't do it. But if you write in your journal and give yourself some time to go inside, I think that's a very helpful tool. Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. And then I just want to finish this up with the counselor part of the contract. You say, as your counselor, I agree to, one, serve as a guide and facilitator of your growth process within a trusting and safe environment. Two, share my observations and give you feedback of my impressions. Three, have faith in and believe in you. Four, work for your well-being and healthy functioning in every way. And five, maintain professional and ethical standards throughout our work. And then there's a place for you to sign. So I assume you give them a copy of this? You each have a copy?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And I just want to illuminate or amplify that idea of having faith in and belief in the client, because they sense, the clients will sense that you do have faith in them. They may not have any faith in themselves. They may not believe in themselves. They're feeling so down and so discouraged. But somehow, this guy believes in me. I must be worth something. So I'm being valued. That has enormous healing effect, I think. And it's not a phony thing. I mean, I do think the human potential is in all of us. And even this client who I've seen for more than 20 years periodically, and she's very slow to develop into her full potential, she's made great gains and great strides in so many ways. Just hanging on has been and raising that boy of hers in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it gives people strength to know that somebody has faith in them and believes in them.
Definitely, definitely. Well, what kind of reception has your book had?
Well, and I don't have
these ideas about bringing.
I'll tell you a couple stories about that. I've had some feedback directly from the people that have read it, and then I get some royalties from the publisher. That tells me it's doing pretty well. Most recently, I found out that it's been taken on in Spain. They've translated it in Spanish, and it's also been taken on in India.
Oh, how wonderful!
Yeah,
that's got to be very gratifying. About that. Yeah.
And it's also in German and Chinese. So,
oh my goodness!
That I think it's very satisfying to learn about that. And so I think it's doing pretty well that way. And then the more personal feedback, I've had a few calls, such as your nice kind words here today. But I got an email last year about this time from a person in California who said, "This is the best book I've seen on spirituality and counseling, and do you ever come out here to do a workshop?" And I said, "Well, set it up, I'll come." I'm on my way to Hawaii. I did present it last year in Hawaii, and I said, "I'll be in California." And anyway, it was just nice, and he said, "Well, I'm just a graduate student, I can't do that, but I would like it if sometime it could happen." And as it turns out, when I was in California, I told him to call me. I gave him a number, and he did, and we played some golf together. He was a wonderful man. good things like that happen, and I appreciate that.
Well, if I were teaching a counseling course now, I would certainly want to use it. I think your book ought to be required reading in all counselor and therapist training programs.
Oh, you're very kind. That's the idea.
Yeah, and I want to let people know it's a slim paperback of less than 200 pages, but it packs a lot of wisdom and a lot of, as you can hear, practical suggestions.
Yeah.
Well, Dwight, we should tie a pretty ribbon on this here.
I really appreciate your. I'm very honored that, which I just want to recognize that spiritual connection that you are, so validating and so recognizing of my efforts here, and to make this call is wonderful for me.
Well, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. That's great. And all the best to you, David.
Okay.
And at risk of sounding too schmaltzy, I will say I love you, brother.
Yeah, I love you too, brother. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with my good friend, Dwight. I'll try to keep my post-interview commentary brief. I let that interview run long because he's such a special person to me, and I really wanted to share him with you all. Dwight's about 7 years older than me, and he's a mix of friend, role model, big brother, father figure, hero, and peer, all rolled into one. We met in 1977 when I began a 2-year exchange at the University of New Hampshire. I traded my job and my house with a psychology professor at UNH for what was supposed to be a 1-year exchange. He got my tract home in suburban Northern California, and I got his lovely cottage on a lake in the New Hampshire woods. We both enjoyed the trade so much that it got extended into a second year. One of my colleagues at Sonoma State suggested I look up a guy named Dwight Webb, who he seemed to recall was working at UNH. I later learned he had met Dwight a year or two before I was hired at Sonoma. Dwight had applied for a job at Sonoma. They liked him a lot, but there was no opening at the time. Well, you know how it is when somebody says, hey, you ought to look up so-and-so. I said I would, but didn't really have much of an intention to do so. But when I got to UNH and it was time to teach my first classes there, it turned out that I had a room conflict with another professor. I had put in to teach my class in the one good room there at the University of New Hampshire for the type of process-oriented classes I like to teach. It was a carpeted room in the business school that was set up in the round. It was designed so that students could sit comfortably on the floor in a circle, which makes it ideal for group process-type classes. I thought I was scheduled into this perfect room, and it turned out that some other guy was also scheduled for it at the same time. So I figured I'd call up this other guy, ask him out to lunch, and see what I could negotiate. Well, it turned out that this other guy was Dwight Webb, the very person my Sonoma State colleague had suggested I should look up. Dwight and I met for lunch and quickly discovered we had a lot in common, including the fact that he had applied for the job at SSU, that's Sonoma State, a year or so earlier. We also discovered that we were both rebels in some similar ways and that we were both folk musicians. What could have started out as an adversarial situation over the carpeted room quickly turned into a deep friendship that lasted all these years. And by the way, he very graciously gave way on the carpeted room. My friend Dwight is a very large spirit. He's a very interesting blend of a man's man and a gentle poet and artist. I used to joke with him about being the ultimate mesomorph. Sometime back, there was a psychologist by the name of Sheldon who developed a typology based on 3 body types, mesomorph, endomorph, and ectomorph. The ectomorph is the person with a naturally skinny, small-boned body and a high-strung, nervous personality that supposedly goes along with that body type. And the endomorph is the heavy-set person who is supposedly very centered on pleasures and is somewhat indolent. And the mesomorph is naturally lean and athletic, and according to Sheldon, is the sort of personality that is naturally full of self-confidence and optimism. Now, I haven't done justice to Sheldon's typology in this brief description, but Dwight always struck me as the living embodiment of Sheldon's ideas about the mesomorph. Something over 6 feet tall and solidly built, Dwight had played football when he was in college, and when I knew him in his prime, he was an avid skier, both downhill and cross-country, and a ball player, and a hiker, and a tennis player, and a sailor, and a golfer, and on. A very physical guy. He's the father of 4 sons, now counselors all, last I heard. And he's grandfather to many. He's friends to a great many and has always hosted the most wonderful parties and family gatherings in which music plays a big role. He's a wonderful singer, guitarist, banjo player, and pianist. Now, he's not technically great on any of these instruments, and he'd be the first to tell you so, but it is his spirit that shines through his musical playing that ignites and enlivens everyone else in the room. I'm a musician of very modest talents myself, but I've never felt more fulfilled as a musician than when making music with my friend Dwight. And what a real gift that's been. I saw Dwight go through a marital breakup and then a divorce in the early days of our relationship. His 4 sons were fairly young at that time, and yet he stayed very present in their lives and even managed to stay present in his former wife's life. To the extent that they are both remarried now to new partners and yet celebrate holidays and family gatherings together, I don't know anyone else who has pulled that off to the degree that Dwight has, staying friends with the ex and integrating the new families. He essentially left that marriage for another woman whom he absolutely worshipped. They were a happy couple for several years, and I enjoyed wonderful ski trips and musical evenings with them. In the end, though, she left him for another man. It's hard to see a big man fall, but Dwight took this loss very hard and grieved it with as much passion as he brings to the rest of his life. Out of that grieving and subsequent healing process came his book, 50 Ways to Love Your Lever. Now, he wrote this book well before the recent spate of books and research on forgiveness. He realized not only did he need to forgive the woman that left him, but that he really needed to love her, which is a profound spiritual insight in itself. As so often happens in the wake of divorce, Dwight's economic status was suddenly halved, but that didn't slow him down a bit. The local bank had a limited number of special loans, and Dwight camped out overnight in front of the bank so that he could get the loan when the bank opened the next morning. With the money that he was able to borrow, he bought a beautiful piece of country property and proceeded to build a wonderful post and beam house, largely with his own labor. Then he found love again and married a beautiful and soulful young woman, Leslie. She desperately wanted to be a mother. He was already the father of 4, and by this point was either in or close to his 60s. But he supported his wife's longing, and they adopted a baby from Russia. And then they moved to a beautiful house on a lake, and now in his 70s, he's moved again to a much larger house, much of which he's worked on building or remodeling himself again. When I first got to know Dwight, I was the father of 2 children. Shortly after we left New Hampshire, we unexpectedly had twins, doubling our family to 4 children. I felt fairly overwhelmed at first, but I had received such wonderful role modeling from watching the love and enthusiasm of Dwight fathering his 4 sons. It was a source of strength and inspiration for me. I'm remembering also that when I first met Dwight, he was teaching an extension course on baking sourdough bread, in addition to all his other teaching. A visit to Dwight's always involves a lot of sourdough bread and sourdough pancakes. And for a number of years, I followed suit, keeping the sourdough starter going that he first gave me and which had some sort of noble lineage, I think going back to like colonial times or something. Even though we shared only 2 years in New Hampshire, we've kept the flame of our friendship alive for 30 years now. I've watched him grow through divorce and loss and marriage and 2 books and 3 houses and travels to foreign countries and grandparenthood. Whenever I visit, I feel folded into his family. He calls me Brother David, and I'm proud to call him Brother Dwight. I said I was going to keep it short, and I failed to do that. I hope you'll forgive me for going on. How could one not experience healing and soul from the love of such a man? I don't know if our interview has done justice to him. In the best of all worlds, you'd be with the two of us making music together.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Well, I'm a little self-conscious about how long today's show has run, but I've also felt badly that it's been a while since I got one out. I had two different scheduled interviews fall through, and then the holidays caught up with me. So I'm not even going to urge you to put yourself on the Frapper map or to fill out the listener survey. However, you may recall that I had been offering to send a copy of the book I co-authored about the Zodiac serial killer to some lucky person who put themselves on our Frapper map. So I'm proud to announce that Gordon Shippey of Tucker, Georgia, is the randomly chosen winner of my book. In response to my email to Gordon, letting him know about his good fortune, he wrote back, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I want to thank you for the book and for your outstanding podcast. I've been listening for a few months now, and it always makes me happy to see a new show available for download. One of the reasons I listen is that my future is in psychology. I'm applying for admission to the master's program in professional counseling at Georgia State University. My dream is to have my own counseling practice a few years from now. Some of the things you've said in the podcast have encouraged me greatly, including your comment that the master's degree is sufficient for practitioners and experience makes the best therapist. However, a recent comment gave me pause. You mentioned that managed care is driving therapists out of their practices, and you yourself left for this reason. While I'm not becoming a counselor for the money, and I won't be deterred just because it might be harder to break into this business than some others, I am concerned. Can you think of any resources, papers, or books I should read, or people I should talk to that can help me understand the challenges of creating a thriving practice? I would be very grateful if you could. Maybe this topic would also be good for a show, the business of therapy, how therapists make a living or how they fail to, and how they interact with the managed care bureaucracy. Thanks again for all the great information, Gordon." Here's what I wrote back to Gordon. "It's good to hear from you, and again, good to hear of your plan. I was probably more negative about the managed care thing than necessary. Really good counselors and therapists will continue to succeed. So learn to be the best counselor you can be. It also helps to specialize in an underserved area, for example, children or autism and so on. Also, you might want to talk to some MA-level counselors in your area and ask them about their perceptions. Let them know that you're a student and that you're trying to find out about the profession. They should be helpful. There are multiple reasons why I stopped practice, and managed care was only one of them, an aggravating factor, let's say. Also, I already had a full-time teaching position and was already launching another career in market research, which conflicted with keeping regular therapy appointments. So if that's your dream, Gordon, and all the rest of you out there, don't give up on it. Yes, managed care does present some challenges. Maybe it'll go away eventually. I don't know. But there are people who are making it despite managed care." Well, there's lots more good email, but I think that better wrap it up for today since I have been running long. As always, I want to thank our show sponsors, Podshow, who you can check out at podshow.com, and GoDaddy at godaddy.com, where the secret word is shrink3 to get a discount. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo. You'll find the link to that on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. Thanks again to my good friend Dwight Webb for the interview. Our next show will be with Dr. John Drimmer, clinical psychologist, television producer, and Hollywood writer. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.